Welcome to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We're delighted to have you with us today. This is the second day of our panel, and we have three cases on the docket this morning. We'll take a short break after the second case because we need to set up some audio equipment for one of the attorneys. You're probably familiar with our lighting system. If you're not, when you see the yellow light, that means your time is about to end. And when the red light comes on, that means your time has ended. And so you should wrap up your the last brilliant thought that you have. You should just say that and then sit down. And I'll remind you if you don't. But we're delighted to have you with us today. And so we'll call the first case. Number 20-30524, Raymond Harold Kimball III versus Joseph LoPinto et al. And we'll hear from Ms. Casey. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Anna Casey on behalf of Mr. Raymond Kimball. The question in this appeal is whether the district court applied the correct legal standard when it dismissed Mr. Kimball's claims challenging the conditions of his pretrial detention. We submit that the district court did not. First, it was error for the district court to dismiss his sex-based equal protection claim as frivolous. The Supreme Court in VMI has been clear, all gender-based classifications today warrant heightened scrutiny. His claim challenging the grooming policy should have triggered heightened scrutiny, but it did not. Second, it was error for the district court to fail to even address his other equal protection claim. Mr. Kimball's claim that he was placed in a punishment cell because he was gay was adequately pled and articulated through live testimony in front of the magistrate judge.
Let me ask you a quick question about that. The magistrate held a Spears hearing. I've looked at it a little bit. Did the magistrate specifically ask Mr. Kimball during the hearing about the nature of his sexual orientation discrimination claim?
She asked him in the discussion about the administrative segregation. She says, "Is it totally random where your cell ends up?" Mm-hmm. And he says, "No, mine wasn't totally random." The magistrate judge probes further, and he says, "I was there because I was being punished." And she actually asks, "Why were you being punished?" And he says, he's unequivocal. He says, "This is an ROA 313, because I told Sergeant Silvernagle that I was gay."
Yeah, I saw that. And so then your argument is that the magistrate simply failed to address that claim altogether.
Correct.
The magistrate did purport to apply rational basis review to a claim about him being in the ADSEG.
I think that she misunderstood part of his claim, and she goes through analysis seeming to take equal protection analysis for incels versus middle cell individuals, so I think that that's what you're thinking through. She says something like, he's not in a suspect class, he has no fundamental right.
Saying, yeah, that's what I'm getting.
And so that, I think, that's a different issue. Here, you know, he both pleads in his complaint, it's actually in his pro se brief, obviously it's in my supplemental brief as well, that he says, "I was being punished because I was gay." If you look at the magistrate judge opinion, or the report and recommendation that becomes the opinion, she never mentions his sexual orientation, she never mentions an intentional discrimination theory, which he, you know, obviously it could be more clear, but he is a pro se incarcerated plaintiff at this point, and in the live testimony.
While we're on this, I know we want to go back to the grooming policy, but while we're on this issue, has he pled or at any point in the Spears hearing explained that his statement that he was gay directly related to his cell assignment, or is that a conclusion that he's drawing that he told him that and then the cell assignment was made, that he's associating the reaction, or did anyone at the jail say, "Oh, well, because you're gay, this is how we're going to incarcerate you pending your trial or hearing"?
Right. So I think here the interaction with the magistrate judge, taking that question first, she says, "Was your assignment random?" And he says, "No." And he says, "I was being punished." She says, "Why were you being punished?" He says, "Because I was gay." So at that point, you know, that is his allegation, that he was placed there because he was gay. He doesn't have, you know, an intentional moment.
There's no jail policy, and there's not a statement of a guard or anybody saying, well, if you're gay, this is where we're going to house
you. Right. Mr. Kimball doesn't allege that all, you know, homosexuals are placed in a specific thing, but rather, you know, in a traditional, you know, if you think of an employment discrimination, he alleges circumstantial evidence, including, you know, pretty offensive anti-gay statements that are made by guards. And then when he notifies guards that he's sick of being picked on, they say, okay. And then they put, the next thing he knows, they put him in a cell that's known as a punishment cell, both to him and to others. Turning to, I guess, starting with the...
Yeah, so the grooming. So did the magistrate or the district judge, you say that they applied the wrong standard review. Did anyone cite our, I mean, we have obviously a long line of precedents that say that separate grooming policies is constitutional. I think what is the first case on that? Hill?
Is
that
Hill is the published case on that, and I think the first one as well.
Okay, so was that cited? Was that case cited?
So the magistrate judge does cite Hill. That's, and she cites, I think, an unpublished case. I think it's Ryan v. City of Mansfield. Okay,
so I mean, I understand your argument, but if Hill is still binding precedent, then the claim is frivolous. Is it not?
I think that here, while even if the district court applied binding Fifth Circuit precedent, I think here this court has said, you know, multiple times that it has both the authority and the obligation to implement changes of law. And here, Craig v. Boren, which is actually decided about 3 months after Hill, you know, announces heightened scrutiny as the appropriate standard of review for all gender-based classifications. So that would be, I mean, we submit an implicit change of law, if not express change of law.
Is this in the 70s? Is that when Craig is a...
Craig is 76.
Craig is different. The young boys drink more than young women, so we're going to not sell them to the... Isn't that what Craig versus Boren?
So Craig is 76, and it is the near beer case out of Oklahoma. Right. It's decided a couple months after Hill, which I think is important when you run through the analysis of whether or not this panel can announce a change of law that the Supreme Court has, you know, or that the Supreme Court has announced.
When was Turner versus Safely decided?
Turner versus Safeld, I think, is... I would not be exactly sure. I'm pretty sure it is after Craig, but I'm not positive.
Okay, so because that's, I'll tell you frankly, my difficulty with this is that we are in the prison context.
Right.
And we have a long line of cases that apply Turner, Turner giving a lot more discretion in the prison context.
Right.
We have even cited Turner in a gender-based prison conditions case since VMI. So I hear what you're saying, but it seems like we have continued to apply the Turner idea of greater deference to prison officials in terms of gender-based differences in prisons. So it's difficult for me to see that this, the VMI decision was 97.
Right, or so 2000, I think.
It was somewhere around.
It's definitely after Turner, that's for sure.
It was after Turner. So 2000, so now we're on the eve of 2023. So that's, you know, two decades and change where our court just hasn't noticed that the analysis changed.
Your Honor, I think obviously this was not, you know, briefed to this court that Turner was applied, right? I filed my supplemental brief and there was no response saying...
I recognize you're...
Doesn't apply.
Pro bono in this case, you're operating...
But I do think on the merits, I think Johnson v. California, which is a Supreme Court decision out of 2005, is extremely important. There, the equal protection claim is a race-based claim. There, the defendant said, you shouldn't apply strict scrutiny, this is a prison. And the Supreme Court says no. The Supreme Court says actually deference to prison administrators is fundamentally at odds with equal protection jurisprudence because the government's power is at its apex in a prison context and searching judicial review is appropriate. Well, unlike other, oh sorry, Judge.
I was gonna say, following along on our timeline of cases though, we also have Longoria from this court, which I think too is consistent with our prior cases in spite of your argument about the heightened standard.
Right.
How would you distinguish that? Or do you think that we should just either take this case en banc eventually, or is that your ultimate goal? Or is there some way for us to grant you the relief that you want on this claim, or at least to reverse the district court at this time and distinguish those cases?
I think here the important, you know, and Judge Duncan mentioned this before, but I think the important thing here is at the pleading stage, this is at least a non-frivolous claim. The Supreme Court has adhered to the announcement in Craig v. Boren that heightened scrutiny applies when there's a gender-based classification time and time again. I think it would be difficult to write an opinion that is in direct, you know, conflict with this line of cases. I think, as I said, in Johnson v. California out of the Supreme Court, this, you know, while there are some constitutional rights that might need to be impinged in certain prison contexts, the Supreme Court has suggested that equal protection jurisprudence is, you know, equal protection rights are not some of those rights. You know, and here in the practicality, they, appellees in the grievance policy kind of faintly point towards hygiene and security as their justification for haircut policy. Of course, that's not a justification for a gender-based haircut policy, and the Supreme Court has said.
Well, I mean, it might be. I mean, if we're just speculating. I mean, so the, what is the policy for with respect to women's hair length?
It's shoulder length.
So shoulder length. I mean, you a woman couldn't have very long hair, as so shoulder length. So there's some difference. The men's is, I don't know what how you articulate the men's policy, but they could be both geared towards some kind of hygiene-based. Or safety-based interest of the prison, but there's a slight difference between men and women's grooming because as I walk outside and look around me, I see a slight difference between men and women's hair length, right? Not always, but often.
That's exactly a justification for a haircut policy, right? But it's not a justification for a gender-based one. So the idea...
Why not?
Well, the idea would be, you know, clearly the appellees care about the hygiene and security of females, and they don't believe having shoulder-length hair is going to hopefully to impinge on their hygiene and security having shoulder length, but somehow they think that men's hygiene and security would be, you know, put at risk by having longer hair.
No, my point was that a prison could reasonably recognize that men and women often have different hair styling choices.
Right, but I think the lesson of VMI is even if, you know, often certain men and women have different preferences, the Supreme Court has said that gender-based classifications must have an exceedingly persuasive justification. You know, Justice O'Connor, I think, makes the comment in VMI, you know, while the defendants say most women couldn't meet the physical strengths that VMI requires, most men couldn't either, right? So here, most men
have... Well, VMI is a very different case. I mean, VMI, they weren't letting in any women. And they were saying, well, you have this separate school over here. I forgot what it was called.
Right.
And that school appeared not to be even remotely the same as VMI. But doesn't Justice Ginsburg wrote that opinion, right?
Right.
So is there any discussion there? I mean, just because you have you have to let in women to VMI, do you have to have the absolute same grooming standards, absolute same physical readiness standards for men and women at VMI?
So I don't think the lesson of VMI and the other modern equal protection claims are that you have to have the exact same standards. I think that the lesson of those cases is that when the government treats men and women differently, purely basis on the basis of sex, they have to have an exceedingly persuasive justification. You know, we started this conversation with Craig v. Boren. You know, at issue in that case is not entrance into the illustrious VMI, it's access to near beer, right? So I think any sense that the Supreme Court, you know, is only concerned with certain, you know, more kind of seen as Heidi, you know, more important things like education, is I don't think it's consistent with the Supreme Court's precedent. I think the Supreme Court has said, give us a gender-based classification and we will subject it to heightened scrutiny. VMI even says gender-based classifications are inherently suspect, which is what we have here. So I don't think that's consistent with Turner, and I think that that Johnson v. California is illustrative of that as well here. I mean,
if we agreed with the premise, then we would subject every single prison policy that differed between a men and a women's prison to exceedingly what persuasive justification for every single policy.
I think the less, like, if you rule in our favor, the question is whether plausible claims are stated, right? So I think you could have regulations where it was so obvious that the justification, you know, is exceedingly persuasive, something like if the at issue is sexual violence or something, where you could say that claim is not plausible. I mean, plaintiffs meet a 12B6 standard in the prison context and other contexts, you know, over and over.
Are you saying that there's no regulation permissible that is indexed by sexual orientation or gender? Are you saying that while perhaps admissible, it was rather deployed here in a punitive fashion?
So I think that there's...
There's one thing in punishing someone for their status, and it's something else in terms of the prison's ability to sort the inmates. I mean, there's a real interest in sorting out. You don't put females and males together in a prison environment. I think that would be an awkward situation in some ways. And so you say, well, we're not talking about male or female, we're talking about a person who's gay. And the person who's gay also presents disciplinary problems and safety problems for that person themselves in a prison environment. I mean, most of those people in there are for good reason. So I have difficulty sorting out exactly what you're saying. We have all this body of law, but that's just gender-based. We moved here, we're talking about running a prison that protects with the duty of the state to protect the prisoners. When you take away their liberties, you've got to correspondingly to protect them. And so are we talking about just the fact that in this particular situation there was a punitive action taken? Or are you talking about something, but I don't see how that sweeps so broadly.
Right.
You may answer, please.
I think, you know, there's three claims at issue. So I think I'm responding to the third equal protection claim that's based on his sexual orientation. Sorry, responding to his equal protection. I think your question is related to a sexual orientation equal protection claim. There, the allegation is that he was punished because of his sexual orientation. I think, as you flagged, you know, that the appellees are responsible for protecting Mr. Kimball as he's incarcerated. I would note that in Johnson v. California, actually the allegation there was that they were making race-based classifications to reduce racial violence, and even there the Supreme Court said that's not enough.
But what I'm trying to get at is that it's one thing to have a case where you allege that this person is gay and they were punished, treated differently,
right.
And it's a matter of punishment, not in response to safety standards, et cetera. That seems like a one-off situation. That perhaps they have a claim individually, but to say that necessarily implicates the total regime standards, it troubles me.
I think our third claim is that it is an equal protection violation, that they're not, you know, while we do make a due process challenge, which is claim two, in claim three, he's alleging that he was treated differently because he was gay, and they placed him in a punishment cell because he was gay, while other straight detainees were placed in middle cells that have better, you know, advantages, less restrictions, because of his sexual orientation, when he told the guards he was gay, they placed him in a punishment cell. So that is an intentional discrimination theory.
What's the factual support for this being something other than a one-off situation?
So here,
they've repeatedly done that. You have evidence that they've done this to others, et cetera, et cetera.
So he does not claim that the guards placed all gay people in punishment cells. Rather, he claims that he was subject to anti-gay offensive statements. I think I think of the record, but they had, you know, statements that they made to him that are pretty offensive that are in the record as well. And then when he notifies the guards, I'm gay, I don't want to be in a two-person cell, they say, okay, and then they put him in what's known as a punishment cell. So that is his allegation. He claims, again, that punishment cell wasn't just the open, available cell, but rather they actually had to move Merton Bailey, another detainee, to make room for him. So these are the factual allegations that support his theory that he was placed there because of his sexual orientation.
Is there any other evidence of differential treatment other than this situation?
There isn't other factual allegations that this prison has a policy of punishing all gay individuals. Rather, his claim is that he was placed in a punishment cell because of his own particular sexual orientation.
Okay, thank you. We'll have time for rebuttal. Mr. Malili.
Good morning. May it please the court, James Malili on behalf of Sheriff LaPinto. I wanted to first direct my attention to some of the questions raised by your honors. Judge Engelhardt brought up that there was an issue regarding, you know, whether or not, what evidence there is vis-a-vis whether he was put in a cell because he said he was gay. And there is no factual record, and there's certainly at the very least an issue about the temporal proximity of any such claim, right? That when did a guard allegedly tell him what he told him, and how soon after that was he allegedly put in a disciplinary cell? There's no evidence in the record.
Well, are we at the pleading stage?
I'm sorry?
We're at the pleading stage, right?
Correct. This is true. But I don't think that's adequately pled either. Is it? I don't think he states that immediately upon notifying the deputy that he was gay, he was placed in a punishment cell. But you just heard counsel say that he complained. And look, there are a lot of claims before this court involving this particular individual, and there are several cases in the lower court in the Eastern District as well as the Middle District of Louisiana brought by this particular individual. So he's well versed in finding the law and asserting claims that fall under the purview of the law.
Well, that's why I asked at the outset about the Spears hearing, because I did sense that there were multiple claims brought, and the magistrate had a hearing properly, I assume, to try to narrow down what exactly he's claiming.
That's correct, and she did, and they were sufficiently narrowed. If you look at the record, there are a plethora of grievances filed just pertaining to this particular lawsuit. I would submit to you that if you go to Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, it would go to the ceiling of this building.
We'll take your word for that.
But he was put in the cell because he complained he couldn't be in a two-man cell, and somewhere in the record he filed to amend his complaint where he's complaining about, you know, he didn't like admin seg, and then he went back to general population, didn't like that either because he was being threatened for being gay. So, you know, the allegations are all over the place. I agree with Your Honor that the judge had the Spears hearing to try and understand what exactly he was saying. It's still not at all clear.
Yeah, what they're saying is that the magistrate narrowed the claim. She did address the ad seg claim, I'm being put in 13 and not 4, but she didn't address the specific I'm being punished because of my sexual orientation claim. That's what they're saying.
And I have nothing to speak on that. Again, the magistrate judge issued her report. I didn't follow a dispositive motion or pleading. The record before the court is not the record I produced. But I believe, as I think perhaps you, Judge Duncan, said, she did loosely address the claim. While she does not in her report and recommendation at any point mention that he was alleging that he was punished for being gay, she applies the relevant standard, which is, in the prison context, the rational basis standard, and she finds, while she doesn't mention the claim that he was punished because he was gay, she finds that he wasn't a member of suspect class, he wasn't implicating a constitutional right, rational basis test applied, and that there was a rational basis for the assignment to administrative segregation. I think she addresses the claim sufficiently that it's not, this court is in a position where it needs to remand to further address it. With regard to Judge Duncan's claim, the Hill is precedent, right? Judge Engelhardt, you mentioned Longoria.
What standard did the court apply, did the district court apply here?
In which, I'm sorry, Judge, which
with regard point? to the grooming policy?
The
I mean, you prevailed, but the question is, I think our task is to determine whether the court applied the proper standard. I think counsel properly framed the question. So what standard did the court apply, and why is that correct?
Okay, so and it was a very well-framed issue. The magistrate judge simply dropped Hill into the middle of the report and recommendation and found that because Hill is precedent, it's frivolous.
Yeah, I mean, she says federal courts have long held it's not unconstitutional for penal facilities to have different policies regarding hair length for males and females, see Hill, et cetera.
That's the extent of it.
And so, that, you know, it's a very general statement. I mean, obviously, it doesn't go, well, you know, and then there's this standard of review, and it's an intermediate scrutiny, and da-da-da-da-da.
Well, in addition, I found that in researching, you know, in Longoria and also Williams v. Hoyt in the 1977 case, also adopted Hill, and as did an 11th Circuit with an 11th Circuit case, Knight v. Thompson, with approval. In a lot of these cases, in other district court cases as well, that's how that claim is handled. You know, it's Hill, therefore frivolous.
Do you agree that it's a frivolous claim? I sense that you agree that it is a non-meritorious claim.
Well,
you agree it's a frivolous claim.
I want to agree with, I should say agree with you. I think because Hill is precedent and because Hill stands for what it says as it is now, then the claim before the district court was frivolous and that the magistrate
judge. Are you aware of any case from any circuit court, evidently not ours because we haven't addressed it, that applies the intermediate scrutiny framework from VMI to a prison grooming policy?
Certainly not. I tried to find that. Certainly not in this circuit. And the other thing about VMI is, as you said, and a lot of those other cases cited by plaintiffs, is those are really statutory, state statutory schemes that created a dichotomy. Here, again, while the magistrate didn't address it, all the cases that do address it, we start with the proposition this is a prison setting and that prison officials have broad discretion in overseeing jails and in the area of conditions of confinement. But that it's a prison setting is certainly important. And that's why that standard is applied.
I can imagine we have cases, I think I read one, about the relative conditions between men and women's prisons. And someone might say, well, the conditions over here in the men's prison are awful. The women over here are in better conditions, and therefore that's a gender-based equal protection violation. I can imagine we have some cases.
Well, as you suggest, I can imagine.
I think we do.
Myriad examples of it in every context, in every policy. I mean, I do this for a living. I've done this for 20 years. I can imagine going through every single policy.
I mean, the irony is VMI is about having separate institutions for men and women.
Right.
And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not okay because of the unique qualities of VMI, and the women weren't going to get that. You know, those. But here, nobody would suggest that we can't have men and women's prisons.
No.
At least, I mean, I shouldn't say that. Somebody will suggest it.
And again,
it seems a claim that would be a difficult one to make.
Certainly, and there's no dispute that the purpose of the policy vis-a-vis men is the health and hygiene and safety of the prison. You know, Bell v. Wolfish held that the government has an interest in making sure that weapons and drugs don't enter the prison and aren't available to detainees. And there's no doubt in this case or in a lot of other cases that have addressed similar issues that, you know, that's one way you smuggle weapons and contraband into a jail, right? Is if you have a bunch of hair and you...
I wonder what the remedy in this case would be. Would it be to make the women prisoners have the same hair length?
Yeah, I mean, and then again, you brought up the good point about shoulder length. I don't know that that's so disparate. You know, we're not talking about women can grow hair as long as they want or can have dreads or can, whatever else you can imagine. You talk about the difference of maybe an inch above the collar line. I'm not sure.
Why would there be a difference in hygiene? You just mentioned maybe smuggling things in their hair, like weapons or blades or something like that. I'm not so sure that the rationale for that is not different for women and men. And with regard to hygiene, I mean, are we just recognizing that women are cleaner than men and have better hygiene? Or is there some particular track record or something in the prison system that causes that policy to be a good one?
Certainly not in the record of this case, Your Honor, no. And you know, I mean, I think clearly it seems there's a concession made for women to wear their hair a bit longer than men.
Yeah, and look, I don't know what a record in a fully developed case. I would be surprised if somebody could prove a hygiene, a distinction in hygiene, would justify that policy, frankly.
Right.
But does that mean it's unconstitutional? I don't know.
I think that therein lies the question, right. Turning to...
Yeah, there's a due process claim.
Yep, the due process claim. Yeah, just quickly, plaintiff appellant took issue with the fact that the magistrate judge cited the Sandin standard. I don't think that the magistrate cited an unpublished opinion, Ryan v. City of Mansfield, which cited the Sandin standard, and they're correct. The district courts apply it all the time. And it's usually applied in much the same manner as it was applied in this case. It's dropped into the analysis, and there's not much analysis. I would submit to the court that if you took that one citation to Ryan and the other cases in the Sandin standard out of this opinion, it would make no difference whatsoever. The reasoning is still sound that his assignment to Ad Sig in this case was not arbitrary or capricious. He asked to be removed from a two-man cell. He was put in administrative segregation. The fact that he was on an in-cell, not a middle cell, is of no constitutional moment whatsoever. So the citation to the Sandin standard notwithstanding, the opinion is still correct, in my view, in that all of the traditional constitutional standards still apply. You know, the plaintiff doesn't have a constitutional right to his classification status. He doesn't have a constitutional right to a certain cell. He's not a member of suspect class, and the rational basis applies, and that his assignment to the administrative segregation was not arbitrary and capricious. So I don't think you even have to get to whether or not Sandin should apply to pretrial detainees. It does in this circuit. The district courts routinely cite the Sandin standard to claims brought by pretrial detainees. There's a couple referenced in the magistrate's opinion. There's a bunch more. Ratley, I found at Barbier's court, and a few others. So in closing, with regard to the equal protection claims, again, I think that the court applied the right standard. The plaintiff's not a member of suspect class. He doesn't implicate a constitutional right. A fundamental right, I apologize, and the rational basis it applies, and he's not stated that there was no rational basis or penological interest advanced in this case. I think the magistrate court said well, to the extent that the plaintiff complained that, you know, this thing where the end cell doesn't get out until the end of the day or the beginning of the day and the middle cells do, I think the court said that the process was imperfect but not irrational. And I think that's well said. We could always probably do better, and maybe that can be looked at, but it's certainly not irrational, and it certainly wasn't done to punish anybody. It's the way the jail operates. There's no evidence that, again, they put him on an end cell to punish him. That's the way they're rotated as a matter of jail policy.
Does it make any difference that he is a pretrial detainee, versus someone who's been convicted, or is it just detention is detention, and this is how we do it?
No, it is a difference. We're a pretrial detention facility, for the most part, and it does make a difference. Pretrial detainees can't be punished for the charges for which they arrested pre-adjudication, and there's no evidence in this case that, even as alleged by plaintiff, that any actions were taken against him because of the crimes with which he was charged. And I would submit to you that, again, there's really no evidence in the record other than plaintiff's allegations that it was a punishment. They moved him to administrative seg because he was having problems with the general population. And I think, then the record gets a little confusing. But the placement of plaintiff in the cell in ad segregation was not arbitrary or capricious, and so, which is the standard for pretrial detainees. And So I think it was lawful. So I have nothing further unless you have some questions.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Casey, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Turning back to his grooming policy claim, VMI, the heightened scrutiny application of VMI has been applied by the D.C. Circuit, the 8th Circuit, and the 9th Circuit in a prison context. Sorry, Judge Higginbotham. The VMI heightened scrutiny has been applied by the 9th Circuit, the 8th Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit in the context of a prison case.
Okay. Any gender? So a case, that's helpful, and you probably cite those in your brief. With respect to men versus women?
Yes.
Okay.
In equal protection sex-based claims.
Okay, and what were the nature of those claims, if you know?
The nature of those claims, I can pull that up. Well, most of them are conditions. So the idea that the female prison might be smaller, that the female, I think the D.C. Circuit one is the female prison is further away from where the families were. So most of those are conditions, which is similar, I think, which is important to prove that heightened scrutiny is not fatal. In fact, it's not strict scrutiny. It accounts for the real differences between women and men, and it allows both the government and prison officials to account for those differences.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a case, Yates versus Stalder.
And
that
I think
it's a conditions case.
Exactly. And Yates instructs this court that when examining these types of equal protection claims, that the record is important. I think Yates at the end says, you know, we owe due deference to prison officials, but on this record, we cannot say that men and women are not similarly situated. So I think.
What relief do you think you're entitled to?
I think here, you know, most immediately we're entitled to an opinion that says this claim is not frivolous and that it should go back to the district court for discovery. You know, Mr. Kimball is an incarcerated plaintiff. He's made these allegations on what he knows, but discovery will show and also give appellees an opportunity to actually articulate a justification for a gender-based classification. That's what happened in, you know, Yates went back for discovery, which is this court's decision, and that's what happened in, you know, the D.C. Circuit case that we cite as well.
Yates is interesting because I have it here in front of me. I mean, we cite Turner. We do not cite VMI.
That's true.
It says, if legitimate penological goals can rationally be deemed to support the decision to treat male and female prisoners differently. That's a 2000 case.
Right.
You know, I mean, we do have to grapple with our own precedent, right? And this panel, as you know, we can't just declare precedent.
But I think this court has said, you know, multiple times that when there's been an intervening change of law, this court has an obligation to implement this.
Yeah, it has to be unequivocal, though.
But I think there's also cases that say when it's inconsistent, which I think is a little bit lower than unequivocal. And I think it's difficult here to show how these things can be, you know, how they can be meshed. I think Hill is an opinion with not a lot of analysis. I think it's an opinion that is inconsistent with Craig v. Boren and all of the progeny. The Supreme Court has continuously adhered to the standard of scrutiny that applies with gender-based classifications, and I think that's appropriate here. On the question, I think you guys had a back and forth about the remedy here. To be clear, this isn't just an allegation that he wants longer hair. It's rather that officials here face, pretrial detainees here face discipline if they have longer hair. So the stakes are higher for these male inmates than female inmates. If Mr. Kimball was a woman, he wouldn't have been disciplined, and here he was, and that discipline turned purely on his gender. Not the conduct, right? Because if he was a woman, he could have had the long hair and not have been disciplined. These differences matter because of that hook. Turning finally to the equal protection claim based on a sexual orientation, the district court did not address this claim, doesn't mention his sexual orientation. What might be kind of confused with rational basis review on this.
Now that I look at it a little bit more closely, I do notice that the magistrate judge talked about disrespectful comments made by the guards. Perhaps that's where the magistrate is factoring in these comments about these anti-gay comments that are referenced in the testimony.
There are multiple disrespectful statements. Some are based to a sexual orientation and some are not. I think it's a stretch to read this opinion as dealing with his sexual orientation claim.
Well, no, it's just dealing with whether allegations of, as the district, mere verbal abuse by prison guards, and, you know, whether it's mere or not, I don't know, but she's treating it under treating, I think it's just being treated in a different
statement,
in a different part of the magistrate's opinion. That doesn't mean it's right or not, but I'm just,
I think Romer and Johnson v. Johnson on this are instructive that discriminatory animus can never be a legitimate government interest. So to the extent you read this paragraph as related to his sexual orientation claim, I think that that reasoning is incorrect.
What is there, there, but and yet analytically we might say there's a difference between verbal harassment by guards, disrespectful comments by guards, and punishment based on sexual orientation.
Right, but I think his allegation, which has sufficient factual support at this stage, is that he was punished because of his sexual orientation, and the statements reveal the intent of that punishment.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I know you're pro bono, and we appreciate a well-argued case.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement.